Welcome to EdTech Weekly, the show that gives you the top EdTech news stories of the week. I'm your host, Ricky Zager, and joining me is Matt Harrison, who is a tech guru in some circles, and he is a guy who also believes in customer service so much that he will, in fact, give you his personal cell phone. Any desire to start the show off with a number the listeners can reach you at, Matt?
Yes, my number is 1-800-RICKY-ZAGER.
Well, that's probably not an accurate phone number. I think that's more than 7 digits. Okay, let's get started with the EdTech news of the week. Ars Technica reports that there's a vulnerability in MasterLock branded padlocks that allows anyone to learn the combination in 8 or fewer tries, a process that requires less than 2 minutes and a minimal amount of skill to carry out. Well, first, why is this EdTech news? Well, I think you're aware, if you're in education, that just about every school is littered with MasterLock Max locks. In gyms, in the lockers, in the hallways, they're everywhere. So schools definitely need to be aware of this information because certainly at least some of their students are going to have this. Does this seem easy enough to do that anyone can actually do it in 8 attempts, as the article suggests?
I would probably say so. I mean, they do reference, you know, different ways that you could be doing it, and they also give you the full mathematical breakdown of it. I'm sure that you probably have to have some skill or desire to do this. But I was looking around the internet, and I think the article itself references it. But this is technology that was made like forever ago, and they've kind of just stuck with it because
it's easy to do.
They're master locks, and it's super cheap to make them. And I can't think of that many people who want to break into them. But that's when I was in high school, and who knows what the kids are up to these days.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there are situations in schools, of course, where you know, paraphernalia, possibly drugs, are in some lockers. So I guess there could be some desire for students to get at that. I mean, if they're into that sort of stuff. So to me, when I read this article, I got to be honest with you, it seemed like this was not something easy to do. We had a thing, I feel like, when I was in school, where, you know, you could listen real close to it and it would make a click, and then that could be the first one, and then you turn it back the other way. And I never was able to make that work. And admittedly, I didn't try this one. I sadly don't have master locks laying around the house. But in the tech world, you know, this brings us to sort of a bigger issue besides just education. I think it is important that teachers are aware of this and administrators are aware of this, because certainly there will be at least a few students trying this, whether it's a prank or anything else. But in the tech world, there is a lot of debate over whether sharing this type of hack information and security shortfalls and systems is a good thing. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great thing to be sharing information like this, especially through a reputable, you know, company like Ars Technica. I mean, they do have some journalistic integrity. It reminds me of several years ago with a black hat going gray hat, and he had found a vulnerability in hotel key card systems and basically said, hey, you've got this big, massive security breach. Yeah, it gave out all the information so anybody could kind of rush and do it, but it did force the industry to actually deal with something that had been a vulnerability for a very long time. I doubt that this is the first person or the first article that was written on MasterLock branded podlocks or padlocks in general being hackable.
Yeah, and I know there's a lot of debate over it, and a lot of the debate I think comes from the side of the companies, as MasterLock may feel a little upset by this because they don't probably want to have to re-engineer their locks, number one, and number two, they don't want that type of publicity. But it seems overall, from what I see in tech news and some of the systems that people can gain access to, when this information comes out, at the end of the day, it's better for everyone. There may be a period of time where hackers are able to exploit that, but at least it's not happening behind closed doors, and it's not happening on, you know, where people are unaware of it. So I think, if anything, this brings that information out, and that's a good thing.
Well, and as a school or administrator, I mean, you can look at this being a vulnerability, and if all of your students in a high school locker room are using master locks, then maybe they should be locking the doors there, and there's added security that can be, you know, placed on that end. So
yeah, I agree. And they can also maybe switch to only the key lock openers. There's other ways to get around that as well. But yeah, it's definitely good for everyone, I think, to be more informed of these vulnerabilities. Our next story, Engadget, informs us that Minecraft is finally creating a free female character that will be available on all platforms soon, including mobile, sometime this summer. Matt, this is a little surprising to me. As someone who has admittedly not gotten into Minecraft at all, I find it hard to believe that this option was ever not available. Is there anything going on here in the background with Minecraft that may have caused this to begin now?
Well, Microsoft does own Minecraft. I don't know if they have dealings in the day-to-day. But, I mean, we did the story last week about Microsoft reaching out to young girls and trying to get them more involved and feeling a part of the community. So seeing stuff like this happen is great. I do know that when Minecraft was developed, I mean, it was a super tiny little project, and, you know, it expanded way faster than anybody probably could have ever seen. And it relied on the community itself to kind of create everything. So, I mean, whereas they're now creating free female characters that you can select from in the beginning, there had been mods that you could do, you know, for quite a long time where you're able to, you know, choose a female character or choose other types of characters.
So the tech community who used that had made options available, but this is the actual company itself coming out and making a their version of a player that has a female representation. It seems to me that, you know, we've had this theme the last couple of weeks, as you mentioned, that Microsoft video about including the girls into the science and into coding. And we had that supermodel article where she was offering scholarship for girls to learn code. It's definitely a step in the right direction. But, you know, as a person who's going to start a business or an education, this should be a part of the conversation at the start of any endeavor, right? Will students or customers feel included? Are we making anyone not feel included? And I think that's probably where this type of thing is good, because it starts to drive that conversation, as we talked about before. All right, we have another report from Engadget, and this one talks about an exhibit at the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment in California. And it's focusing not just on game development, but specifically on women who played roles in some major games. I know that Street Fighter was one that they mentioned. And again, this is sort of furthering that story we had just a minute ago there about, you know, Minecraft having female representation. This is something that, as, you know, the needle starts moving in that direction, we're seeing more and more of this. We're helping to show that next generation that women have been involved and should be involved if they want. It seems as though there are some out there, maybe in the community, maybe some of the commenters in this article and whatnot, that are not thrilled with this, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, you're always going to find people who are detractors and find a way to marginalize just about everything. So the article itself is a great move in the right direction. And I really, really hope that it works. You know, so that in the future we have a greater tech narrative that includes all people, and women specifically more involved in certain aspects. But, you know, it's a step in the right direction, and it's awesome.
Yeah, this reminds me a lot of, in the education world, we talk about things like Black History Month, and you hear some people say, well, why do we need a separate month for that? We don't need a separate month for White History Month and all that, because they're a part of history as well. But if it's not being focused on, just because they're a part of the history, that's not good enough. I mean, we do need to have that next level, that next step of trying to get them involved. And here's a situation where we recently saw that viral Microsoft video of young girls saying they don't feel like they belong in that science community and that tech community like that. And this is just an awesome way. If just a few girls, or even just one girl, goes to that museum and is inspired by what another female has done and feels like she's included in that conversation and can make the world the way she wants it through that particular technology, through gaming and making her own game or being a part of a game. I mean, this is a great thing, but I think you're right. It needs to become a part of the greater, as you said, tech narrative, but in education, it just, you know, women being involved, minorities being involved, it has to be a part of the normal conversation. And unfortunately, it does require special circumstances like Black History Month and other things like that to get us to start that conversation moving so that they are included. And I think it's great that the Museum of Art and Digital Entertainment is doing this. And again, like you said, it seems like it's moving in the right direction. Matt, our final story, and this one's a very interesting conversation. And so we're going to make this as well our tip of the week. The BBC gives us the most thought-provoking article I've read in a while, I would say, about the digital era, and it discusses whether or not it signals the end of history as we know it. I think in terms of what you'd want to do at your school is make sure you read this article, have this conversation with your students or your administrators or your district-level employees, Because honestly, this generation of students may be one of the first, if not the first, that doesn't really create any major content that isn't digital. Matt, this article has a lot of concepts that are pretty complicated when it comes to solutions for how to solve the problems. Any overall understandings of this article you can share?
It depends where you want to start. One of the biggest things I gleaned from this is they do a pretty good job of sort of talking about, you know, history in the context of things that we are have either lost or are going to be losing soon. Language is a great example of things that we'll be losing in the future, as there are small, you know, groups of people that have certain linguistic characteristics that we'll never ever hear again. What I feel that we need to do, and we need to rely on our younger generation to do, is find a way to take this tech data and protect it in a way and create it so that it's readable in many different formats. You think about to the mid to late 90s, where everybody was using tape formats, in the early 80s with 5.5-inch floppy disks, which are all basically pretty much unusable at this point. We need to do a better job of maybe not making data so proprietary that it's able to be accessed in many different ways. You look at projects like archive.org, where all websites are archived as long as, you know, they're within the right to do so, so that future generations can look at things and see them protected.
Yeah, you mentioned about, like, you know, the 5.25 floppies, and I'm sure some of the young people listening to this never encountered those before. The data can be gotten off those disks. We still have some devices that can make that happen, but the problem, as you mentioned, is how do we read the data that's on that device? If you used WordPerfect to save a file, in my understanding, that is not something that is easy or may not be possible to get that file. So even if you still have the file, if you can't open it and read what you've written, you know, this is where we get into that difference between what history has been. There have been scrolls, papers, documents that stand the test of time. Of course, there are things that can destroy those: erosion, fires, theft, all sorts of things. But it seems like the threats to this type of data are a much more taxing on what could happen to them. I mean, if anyone has had their photo or music collections wiped out, that happens, and they know how easily that can be gone forever for them. So it seems as though this digital data poses a threat in terms of security that we've never had to worry about in history before.
And because of that, I think we need to start looking at data differently, in the sense that we need to start looking at it as a resource that we do need to protect. And we need to have public and private funds that are helping to do that. Look at the Sony hack. You know, not many people were talking about, oh, well, you know, we need to have large data companies and large government, you know, sort of working on ways that we can try to prohibit entities from going in and stealing that data. But after that, a big part of that narrative was what was being done to actually protect companies, to protect their data. Because it's a completely transient data resource that we need to protect.
Yeah, it's really, when you start thinking about this, you realize just how deep and complex this is. This isn't just, okay, backing up your data on more than one drive or backing it up in the cloud. Like you're saying, this is a whole different type of structure and a whole different type of way that we need to be viewing what data is and how we treat data. It's concerning to me, as we, you know, especially for students in education, that it's great that we're having them create more digital things, but 10, 15 years from now, what if they can't even open up the artwork that they created using Adobe? Let's say, and it sounds unthinkable, but, you know, 15 years from now, maybe Adobe's not a program anymore, and that proprietary code people don't have the access to. So whereas you and I, and maybe this is unfortunately, we may be able to go into a box and find artwork that we drew up in fifth grade, but this may not be an option for some of today's students. So it's imperative that we really, like you said, look at this as a huge solution for a different way to look at data. Long-term thinking, what, you know, reading this article, you mentioned before, like archive.org, you know, taking sort of snapshots of things that are in the internet going on right now. Is there any other strategies in terms of education that you can think of with students creating data? Is there a way that we can be better stewards of their data, if you understand what I'm asking here?
Yeah. Well, first, I think that there are two big resources that I would love it if students would start to kind of get a handle of. It's EFF.org, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and then reading anything by Tim Berners-Lee. He's one of the guys that helped sort of put structure in place for what we define as the internet now. They've given so many different talks about looking at data and changing protocols and, you know, security, you know, certificates, SSLs, and stuff like that. Personally, I think that we need to start looking at a different structure and then asking those kids to start coming up with their own structure and how to do that. And we need to start protecting them. We need to teach them early on that data itself is easily manipulable, as well as something you can lose really, really quickly at the blink of an eye, and coming up with solutions and how they can protect it. Because as you said, I can go into my closet, I can reach up, grab a box, and it has, you know, artwork I did in the sixth grade, which was absolutely terrible, but at least I have it. These kids may not have that option if they were using something like Adobe Photoshop. So kind of holding companies' feet to the fire and saying, yeah, I understand that I can only, you know, change this by using your program, but can we at least come to some conclusion or some compromise where I'm allowed to access that file without paying X amount of dollars for it?
Yeah, and what you mentioned, I think, is also interesting, too, about, you know, we can find these old things that we created, art that you said are terrible, but it's not really for the creator to judge what should be in terms of history, what should be available, what should be viewed, and how it should be viewed. And that's one of the beautiful things about history and maintaining these documents and pieces of art. Over time, the value of these changes based on our interpretation of the time, what was going on, what the creation meant. There's just so much in this article. I recommend everyone read it. We'll put the show link, the link up on our website. That's 4techteachers.com, the number 4techteachers.com. Definitely read the article. It's a conversation that needs to be had, and especially in education. I know our district, and I'm sure other districts also struggle with even how to share data between teachers and students, what programs to use. And there's always different issues with each and every one of them. Some people don't have their students using email addresses or don't want them to. And there's all sorts of concerns about security of data. But also, as we mentioned, and as this article talks about, being able to access this data, the information that they're creating, the content they're creating in the future is really important. And again, it's not for them to decide if a article that they wrote when they were in ninth grade is important or not. That's something that the history books, you know, and history can define. And if it's not available, then it can't be defined. And that's kind of the sad thing about this. But again, the conversation, I feel like we say this over and over again in this podcast, but the conversation has to happen in order for this change to be made. So I give kudos to BBC for getting this information out there and putting it in a way that, you know, most of us can understand what they're talking about, if not the deeper, more complex issues here, because it is something that needs to be discussed. And it's a completely different world that we're living in the last 15, 20 years than ever before, especially in terms of history. Well, Matt, as always, thanks for joining us. You can follow me on Twitter at 4TechTeachers. That's the number 4TechTeachers. And we will see you next week on EdTech Weekly.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. High five.
High fives all around. Thanks, Matt.